United States versus Statton. And I know I'm going to mess this up. So I'll tell you.
Christian Capiz, Your Honor. Capiz.
Capiz. All right. I'm glad to hear.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Christian Capiz, and I represent Mark Statton. The issue in Mr. Statton's case is whether the government has shown a substantial relationship between 922G9 and an important government goal, which is to reduce domestic gun violence. It has not. Permanently disarming domestic violent misdemeanors like Mr. Statton is a measure that is greater than essential to accomplish that important goal. And so we ask that this court vacate and remand the district court's decision denying Mr. Statton's motion to dismiss. The first reason why the district court's decision should be vacated is because it is obsolete. It's no longer valid. After the judge issued his order denying our motion to dismiss, at the sentencing hearing, several important facts came to light that affect the judge's decision. First and foremost, Your Honor, in the district court's decision denying our motion to dismiss, the district court judge found that because Mr. Statton was on probation on the date of the offense, April 7th, 2009, and that as a condition of that probation, he was specifically prohibited from possessing a firearm, that nudged him completely outside the core protection of the Second Amendment. As it turned out, at sentencing...
Where in your brief is this argument?
This is argued, Your Honor, throughout our reply. It was also mentioned in our opening brief, Your Honor. The court's findings at the sentencing hearing, in which the court actually ordered a revision of the pre-sentence report, is at 265 to 266. The court found that he wasn't on probation such that he was specifically...
So does that make sense procedurally unreasonable? I'm not exactly sure. Help me out here.
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, what happened at sentencing was very helpful to Mr. Statton because in conjunction with finding that he wasn't on probation at the time of his of the offense, the court also found that he lawfully used the three firearms at issue here. So what the judge did is he ordered a revision of the pre-sentence report to find that on the date of the offense, he was on unsupervised probation. He wasn't violating a law by other than 922G9. On the date of the offense. Furthermore, the court held that following a contested evidentiary hearing at the sentencing hearing, that Mr. Statton lawfully used the three firearms for target shooting as well as hunting. And so these two facts are very important. When the court says in his opinion that Mr. Statton is nudged outside the core protection of the Second Amendment, he did not take into account that he was not on probation at the time of the offense, and that with regard to the use of these three firearms...
Well, I had three convictions. District Court, as you pointed out, on pendants, specific aside from that. And that's two more than the defendant in Preston.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So how does this help your case?
It helps our case in several ways. First, it's important to note, Your Honor, that in all three convictions, Mr. Statton never used a firearm. He never even threatened the use of a firearm. And in addition to that, when it comes to firearms, he's a very responsible citizen. He, in fact, testified at the sentencing hearing that he taught his son how to lawfully and safely handle firearms.
Well, the Chester decision is not impressed in this circuit. The concept of whether the defendant's actions took him outside the core protection, and that's the decision on standard of review, the strict standard of immediacy. So maybe I'm just slow to having trouble figuring out how this helps for that.
Your Honor, it helps us out because there is what I like to call a spectrum of infringement. And I took that phrase from the Third Circuit in its Marzarella decision. The Third Circuit said that when we look at the regulations for firearms, there's a spectrum of infringement. On one hand, you have the let's start out with Heller. Heller is an absolute, or the D.C. District of Columbia ban was an absolute prohibition on the possession of firearms. And on the other hand, you have the Marzarella case, which focused on the 922K, which regulates and prohibits the possession of firearms that have an obliterated serial number. In that case, using that regulation, the burden, the infringement on the right to bear arms is relatively light. You can possess a firearm, but it just has to have a serial number on it. That's not a very heavy burden. Your Honor, understandably, it is unlawful to possess a firearm. But what 922G9 does, which makes it closer to the ban in the Heller case, is it amounts to a permanent ban for the rest of the life of the person who is convicted of a domestic violence misdemeanor. He can no longer have a firearm, even if the person is convicted at age 19. And Your Honor, you discussed and you addressed the elements of 922G9. It could simply be a threat to hurt someone in which the person, the defendant, has a domestic relationship with.
So what I don't agree with this question, but I'm still really tough about it. It seems like this argument goes to what the standard of review is going to be. Our circuit precedent. Are you arguing that how your brief argues is also a positive test contrary to certain precedent? No certain court of appeals country has adopted your position. So if you're arguing for something other than a higher level of scrutiny, why don't you tell us what that other proposition is?
Yes, Your Honor. As I was discussing, there's a spectrum of infringement, and we believe that within the intermediate scrutiny, if you look at the First Amendment application of the intermediate scrutiny standard, it varies depending on the regulation, the type of speech being regulated. So if we can envision this spectrum, and if on one hand you have those regulations like 922K, or this court addressed the prohibition of possessing a firearm on a national park. Those are very small infringements. The burden on the individual who has that right to possess a firearm is very low. And so in deciding whether the government can establish a substantial interest in protecting or achieving a certain goal, and then determining what level of infringement is placed upon the individual and that individual's right to bear arms, there has to be more tailoring than what happened in 922G9. 922G9 is a permanent disarmament. And as I was previously was giving... Your Honor, this statistical evidence showed, as the Chester Court determined, that there are many great reasons why reducing domestic gun violence is an important objective. We've acknowledged that, and we've never contested that.
Chester, they had put the evidence on.
The evidence wasn't presented here other than citations, Your Honor. We never had an evidentiary hearing in which there was an...
This court asked parties on this case, you have to brief it. We will brief and government filed these additional authorities, which whoever tried the case below could respond. didn't ask for a hearing, didn't ask for a continuance, didn't ask to appoint an expert on rebuttal. So I didn't object to it. So tell me how this helps you out.
Your Honor, I think it will require a little bit of history with regard to how this played out in the district court. The district court, after we initially briefed the issue, told us in an order to look at the Chester 1 opinion. The court never said, I want to see statistics, empirical evidence showing why there's that 922G9 is a reasonable fit. In our response to that, which came first before the government, we took a look at the government's evidence, and we said that the government's evidence, that is, in other words, we looked at the reasoning, the legislative history with regard to the creation of 922G9. And
how about all the statistical evidence studies?
Those statistical studies and evidence do not help the government's case. Just to give you two examples, Your Honor. With regard to recidivism, the government relies upon a study in Cincinnati. It was a 3-year study. They took a couple of thousand individuals who were arrested for domestic violence. They were just arrested. And they followed them, that group, 3 years later, and found that 17% were rearrested for domestic violence misdemeanors. But then other sources were saying that it could be up to 80% were recidivists. The problem with that study, of course, is it's unreliable. There are many different sources which provided this information. Number two, most importantly, with regard to this particular regulation, that study never took into account how many of those individuals arrested actually possessed or used a firearm.
That's a good problem. The evidence there is submitted to the court. They argue this why the weight of the evidence, but it did. And you didn't offer any rebuttal evidence.
Your Honor, the court credited that statistic and those citations in its decision. The court left open the possibility of an evidentiary hearing, but never had it. To respond, Your Honor, to those statistics, because it would have been besides the point. Our argument, Your Honor, in our opening brief in response to the district court's request for additional briefing, our argument was that 922G9 is a permanent ban, and that the goal of reducing domestic gun violence is not going to be satisfied by permanently banning someone from possessing a firearm. We argued in our brief, before the government cited any of this evidence, we argued that 922G9 was over-inclusive. We argued and showed why it's under-inclusive. We argued and showed why it's overbroad. But
secondly, the information there, what way challenge you
we
other than to say this is good stuff. When you're dealing in an evidentiary perspective, of course, this is that is self aware that you're here to obey. Then it becomes kind of a weight question that JP has alluded to. But don't you then have to come forth something to rebut or ask for a hearing on it to determine whether or not this is evidence that is what it should be?
Your Honor, these were merely citations. There was no studies that were attached to the record. There were no
different age. Citation is just a citation. You can get that thing, you pull up everything in the world. And I don't know. I don't know what you're asking. Should you print it out, bring it all in, and keep it on the desk? That's kind of the way it's done, isn't it? I mean, and again, you didn't challenge that either. Said, wait a minute, I want to see the actual documents or here. Which again, a lot of this goes to if you sit and you allow these things to come in and you don't really make move. Now, I don't disagree that you could get more done. if you've got to move this thing in that direction, you can't simply say, well, here's a citation. Later on, come up here and says, wait a minute, this is on a citation. Maybe you should have printed out the 4,000 pages before it, put it on the desk of this, and go through it. And all you have to do is just put the budget there.
That is true, Your Honor, but again, it would have been besides the point. I see that my time is up. I would like to give a more full response to your answer, Your Honor. Perhaps I can wait until rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Collery.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Liza Collery on behalf of the United States. As I see it, Your Honors, there are now two different sets of arguments before the Court. There are the arguments that the government thought were raised in this case, which we have addressed in our brief. And there are the new arguments that defense counsel has raised in the last few minutes. I'd like to start, I suppose, by briefly addressing the new arguments that I heard raised this morning, and then I'd like to devote the bulk of my time to the arguments that we believe are actually presented in this case. The argument that the district court's decision is now obsolete because in its opinion it referenced the fact, which turned out not to be correct as shown at sentencing, that he was prohibited by a specific condition of his probation from owning firearms, that argument I have never heard before, that somehow this case is obsolete in some way. I have never heard before. Let me just dispose of it very quickly. The district court did state in its opinion that he was prohibited by a condition of his probation from possessing firearms, and that turned out not to be true. But that was just one fact that the district court, of many, that the district court cited. It doesn't make any difference at all. The district court cited it in support of intermediate scrutiny review. And as Judge Agee points out, Chester establishes that the district court was correct. Intermediate scrutiny review applies here. So that's the last thing I want to say about that. Let me just move on. The second point that the defendant seems to be making is that some kind of heightened intermediate scrutiny review should apply here because 922G9 permanently dispossesses a defendant of a firearm. And as this court's decision in Mascandaro makes clear and the Skoyan decision from the Seventh Circuit makes clear, the question of how long someone can be disabled from possessing firearms as a result of a domestic violence misdemeanor is simply not presented in this case. That is to say, Mr. Statton, who was just four months away from his last domestic violence assault conviction and just maybe 16 months away from the one before that, has no standing to raise any claim that someone else could possibly be prosecuted 30 years after their single domestic violence conviction. That's right, but that is true. And the question of whether the length of the disability could render one of those statutes unconstitutional under the Second Amendment in some extreme case is simply not presented here and could only be raised by someone who had standing to raise that. So let me
still go to what if I had some unusual case that in that particular case strict scrutiny would apply opposed to intermediate scrutiny.
Strict scrutiny would apply based on the length of the
but that would be an argument to be made that had was permanently barred from serving. But their antecedent conviction was 25 years ago. Every year since the citizen of the year, still married, convicted in the first case, all that sort of stuff. It seems like to me that's where you would make that particular argument, but it wouldn't go once you've established the level of scrutiny, you're into the two-prong test you always have.
Whatever the arguments would be that could be raised by someone in that situation, they're simply not presented here. As I've just pointed out, Mr. Statton was still on probation from his last domestic violence offense when the events in question here occurred and when he possessed these firearms. So let me move on to what to the issues that we think are presented in this case. As Judge Agee is well aware, the Chester decision remanded to the district court because it found that the government had failed to produce sufficient evidence in support of its claim that the statutes are constitutional. So in this case, the government did present that evidence to the Court of Appeals. So one of the issues that is before the court in this case is the district court, is the sufficiency of the evidentiary showing that the government did. But in addition, in the district court, the government also advanced an argument that was not advanced in the Chester case and that the Court of Appeals noted was missing in that case. And that is a historical argument about the scope of the Second Amendment right. So as we see it, there are two alternative arguments. That's right. But I wouldn't think the district court would have to rule upon that. I don't think that the historical argument is one where the district court necessarily would have any particular expertise. The Court of Appeals could also examine the history and decide as a result of that history whether it thought that an individual like Mr. Statton falls outside the scope of the Second Amendment. But the district court, as you say, relied on the standard of scrutiny argument. Well, I think.
Yeah, I'm taking that too far. I'm trying to understand what our concern and our solution is.
Because, I have two answers to that. Well, there were in fact prohibitions on domestic violence at the time of the founding. Massachusetts, in particular, from the very beginning, made it. Yes, I think if you look at the historical record, you will see that from the very from the beginning of recognition of a right to keep arms, which was in England in the 17th century, all the way through the founding,
almost incredible to me that someone who lives in a way that's characterized as domestic violence today, nowhere near what was characterized back then. So many states have statutes that mean that these are wives, they can do all kinds of stuff. That's all I'm going with that. But I don't think we need to look at the outcome. Because of it, maybe I'll look at it.
I think what the history shows is that at the time of the Second Amendment was adopted, the pre-existing rights to keep and bear arms, which is all the Second Amendment, recognized, was not understood to extend to people who were not viewed as peaceful.
It is pretty obvious for our women to kind of we call that about them was not. Even a pure historical analysis, I would have serious trouble trying to understand this why that.
I don't
necessarily say good boundaries.
I could quibble with you about the history, but I don't think that I need to do that because surely our understanding of what constitutes violence can evolve. And I think it's appropriate to what the history demonstrates is that people who were viewed as not peaceable, as criminals and as people who posed a real danger of injury, were not entitled to a right to keep and bear arms. And if our understanding of what makes you dangerous, what makes you a criminal, and what makes you non-peaceable has evolved, well, then the Second Amendment has evolved along with that. And
I think where we go here is what is the quantum of evidence necessary in order to be able to meet that dangerous and not going to tell us. Isn't that the kind of issue of stuff in this case? The evidence significant that put in this case set foot in the law.
It does. It does. And if the court wants me to move on to the second question, which is assuming arguendo that Mr. Statton had a right to keep and bear arms, that that right was historically understood. Let me address that. Okay, let me just move on to the second question then. Yeah, I don't believe they contest that, Your Honor. In fact, the government's interest is compelling. So, that's right. And we, in the district court, we presented a wealth of evidence to demonstrate the reasonableness of the fit. That same evidentiary showing has now been accepted by two other courts of appeals. The en banc Seventh Circuit and the First Circuit have looked at that same body of evidence and concluded that it was ample to demonstrate the reasonableness of the fit. And as this court pointed out, the defendant has never really engaged at all on the question of this statistical evidence. When we presented it in the district court, they really just made no response to it. And in the Court of Appeals, likewise, although they made it just a very brief argument about the recidivism evidence.
Or the expert a little bit, maybe that was that. No. But all you have is a citation, and I know that question seems like you ask what you're aiming to do certain things, but that proves self guilty. You've got to prove that. All you got is citation.
I certainly think so, Your Honor, and we have citations to social science evidence, which was all, as we point out in our brief, publicly available on the Internet. At no point in time in the district court did either the court or the defendant
issue a notice as something for the citation. You simply have a document there that studies. You love it in nature that what except this of question that somebody from a university did a study and all these statistics in here and this good.
Well, I think that certainly meets our burden of going forward. We provided the case was remanded in Chester for empirical evidence. We provided to the court a wealth of empirical evidence. No, I don't think it's a reasonable doubt standard. And the defendant is raising a constitutional challenge to the validity of
what level of evidence except we all know what the evidence does. So he's got a whole different way in this picture. He has to get on the stand. He can't even testify to this stuff. He qualifies as an expert for those whole rigmarole to show that he is sufficient to say anything. And through the expert witness bring in the evidence.
If I would,
well,
we never went to a hearing, Your Honor. The district court asked for the information. We provided a brief that identified.
Who said it was what it was? I mean, other than a citation, where did it come from?
The studies are published in journals that are publicly available. They're
wonderful, but I mean, I'm really troubled somewhat about that. It's just, and I like study. I love study. I'm just saying, a study, that's it. I mean, this is a court. It seems like somebody ought to come in and say, I'm qualified, I've done this for years and years, been to the greatest schools in the world, and this is your next one. Okay, well, not if you're a study. You study shows, That's a hearing. Simply just, studies is that enough?
I think it is. But the defendant never contested that. The defendant never asked for an evidentiary hearing.
But is this the exact thing that was allowed in other cases?
In the other cases, the Court of Appeals just took judicial notice of the
judicial notice. That's what I'm getting. The question is, does judicial notice require?
I think you could certainly say the district court took judicial notice of them. Certainly. That's right. There was no, the evidence had not been submitted in the district court in that case, but the Court of Appeals had no problem with considering it on its own. There was one dissenting justice who thought that the case should have been sent back to the district court, which is the policy in this circuit. But the rest of the Seventh Circuit thought that it could consider the evidence. If the defendant had challenged... Well,
that had not been...
We think so, yes, Your Honor. I mean, setting aside the fact that we have two alternative arguments, the government believes that this statute can be upheld under intermediate scrutiny review without any empirical evidence at all, just simply based on common sense. Yes.
So how could you prevail here if you didn't have any evidence? You couldn't prevail if you didn't have any evidence.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. This court held in Chester that we needed the evidence. The government respectfully disagreed. But this court held in Chester that we needed the evidence. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. No, Your Honor, I'm not disputing that.
You just said the government disagreed. I'm not trying to be obvious. I'm just trying to understand this case. So when you get, I'm trying to understand it, realize where you're coming from.
No.
Chester says, go back and do the empirical study. My question to you is, are those studies necessary in order for us to reach the results of you?
I guess I don't know the answer to that. I don't think that they would be. And if we had come back, if we hadn't done what the court instructed us to do, and if we'd come back and said, you know what, we don't feel like putting in studies, we're back, we think the statute's constitutional, would we necessarily... That's correct.
So what is evidence?
Well, it's all the evidence that we've cited. Yeah. Well, as I remember it, I mean, Hayes, United States versus Hayes, appears itself to take judicial notice of the fact that firearms and domestic violence are a dangerous combination. So I would think. That's correct. And the legislative history of the statute shows that. So, yes, I think that a Hayes case supports us. I think that if we had not produced this empirical evidence and we had come back before the court without it, we could have relied on common sense, which is what the Hayes case also relied on, to demonstrate a... I think that the two issues that were identified, for example, in the Skoyan panel decision as needing more evidence were, is there recidivism in domestic violence? And the second issue was, does removing a firearm from the home of someone who's already committed domestic violence, can we infer that that will render his family member safer? I believe that both of those propositions can be supported based on common sense alone. But we have strayed very, very far here from the record in this case.
I'm not surprised about that. It just seems to me that from a situation like this, the officer at least takes a positive position to notice something has been done. Or the evidence that you met ought to be more than just one line link to a study.
But the study, I mean, the study's a public
study has, is, I don't know what makes it something valid. Other than somebody called a study.
I don't think the district court was obligated sua sponte to hold an evidentiary hearing when the defendant never contested the validity of any of these studies, never raised a single argument relating to a single study saying, I don't like the look of this one. I think we need a hearing. At no point in time did the defendant ever do that. He cited all of this evidence, and it just went unchallenged.
I'm not saying he didn't do it. I'm just having a problem with just a citation to his study.
There was no authentication problems in this case. At no point in time did...
Authenticity has to do with the study, not only what it is, but it also... How do we use it?
Well, the studies were published in peer-reviewed journals, and it certainly seems to me that at least that they at least met... I couldn't agree with you more.
Of course, the Chester Court agreed.
Well, the Chester Court didn't necessarily hold that we had to come back with evidence. The Chester Court remanded so that we could produce evidence. As I say,
If we remanded it so that you could produce evidence, you had to come back with evidence. You had none.
I don't think, Your Honor, I don't think that Chester necessarily decided what would happen if we had come back with none, and we'd just come back with the common sense argument. If we come back and said, you know what, common sense suggests recidivism is a problem in domestic violence, common sense and shared experience. And if we come back and said, you know, common sense and shared experience support the inference that if you take a gun out of a house of someone with a significant history of domestic violence, their family members will be better protected. I don't know what would have happened, but it didn't.
I understand your argument.
It didn't.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm glad to hear you have time in rebuttals.
Glad to hear. Thank you, Your Honor. That is correct, Your Honor. We do believe that strict scrutiny should apply, but we understand that we are bound by Chester. And within the intermediate scrutiny standard, there has to be this spectrum of infringement, and we believe that 922G9, as it applies to Mr. Stanton, is so overburdensome that 922G9, which was created years before the Heller decision, was not reasonably tailored to ensure that someone like Mr. Stanton, who has a domestic violent misdemeanor, poses a future threat of violence 5, 10, 15, 20 years out. The evidence that the government keeps referring to was essentially the same evidence that drove the introduction and the passage of 922G9 in 1996. And following the district court's order, and I would ask the court to refer to that order, which is at 78 in the joint appendix. First of all, Judge Copenhaver never ordered us to produce any empirical evidence or studies. He simply said, address this case in light of the first Chester case. Now, in our response to the district court's order at pages 99 to 103 in the joint appendix, we specifically addressed the reasons why reducing domestic gun violence was important in 1996. And we said that the government offered evidence back in 1996, which is no different than the evidence presented later on, to justify some restrictive measure. And in our view, a overly burdensome restrictive measure. What the court did below is it was overly deferential to this evidence and said, in 99 to 103 in the joint appendix, in response to the court's request that we address this issue, our motion to dismiss, in light of the first Chester argument, we analyzed the reasons why reducing domestic gun violence led to 922G9. Yes, Your Honor. It is Yes, Your Honor. It is a... No, well, it depends, Your Honor. I think that, as the Seventh Circuit said in the Williams case, and even this court, in an unpublished opinion, remanded a challenge to 922G1 because someone who is a nonviolent felon, maybe perhaps it is too burdensome. Hey, Your Honor, my response to Hayes is, number one, Hayes said that firearms and domestic strife are a potentially violent combination. Of course. Your Honor, that's absolutely true, but why not ban firearms for anyone who is married or has a live-in partner? They can't have firearms. Then we'll absolutely get rid of domestic gun violence. But that still doesn't, it's still under-inclusive because it doesn't take away the right to use a baseball bat or a knife. The reason why 922G9 is unconstitutional is for someone like Mr. Statton, who has lawfully used firearms, as found by the district court judge, who has a minor in the home, why is it that he cannot protect his family, his home and heart, forever as a result of 922G9? 922G8, which requires a domestic violence protective order, it is limited in time, and we address this throughout our brief. We ask the court to consider why a measure such as 922G8 is a better fit. The government never responded. The district court never referred to 922G8 in its opinion. The court was overly deferential to this evidence, which we did address, and I invite the court to look at 99 to 103, which we wrote.
Looked at that, and you don't say anything there. I don't know what time is all this evidence offered by the government.
Because the government hadn't offered it yet. But when the government, Your Honor, my time is up. May I finish my response? When the government filed its brief and cited to this evidence, our response was that they were sidestepping the issue. They never explained to us why this lofty goal of reducing domestic gun violence is to be reduced in a reasonable manner with 922G9 when 922G9 is over-inclusive, under-inclusive, and overbroad. And for all of those reasons, we ask that this court find that 922G9 is unconstitutional.
Thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel, and we're going to take a short break.